it would help get at capital gains, which are an extraordinarily large part of the incomes of the wealthiest individuals. And right now, escape taxation until they're realized, and often they're unrealized and at death, benefit from so-called step-up of basis. So it's not a wealth tax, but a tax on unrealized capital gains of exceptionally wealthy individuals.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen Sunday on CNN describing a tax on billionaires that would help pay for President Biden's ambitious Build Back Better bill. It's an idea that gained traction during the 2020 presidential campaign, backed by progressive candidates such as Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. However, Biden was lukewarm until recently. We're going to look at how this would work, who would have to pay, and how much now with Richard Rubin. He covers tax policy for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So she says, Yellen says, this is not a wealth tax. What is it?
It's right. She's right that it is not a wealth tax, like you've heard Senator Warren and others talk about a wealth tax. So the way those wealth taxes would work, there would be an annual tax on assets. So total net worth, you would pay a portion of that. This is somewhat different. It's a narrower slice of it, in a sense, in that it would say, okay, look at your unrealized capital gains. And what that means is the amount of asset appreciation, how much something has gone up in value over the course of a year, if you're one of the 700 to 1,000 people affected by this. And that would count as income for the year. So say you started with a stock worth $2 billion, and by the end of the year, it was worth $2.5 billion. That $500 million is not income under current law. Under this proposal, it would be taxable income.
Okay. So under current law, you would have to sell your stocks to realize them and then pay taxes. But under this proposal, you wouldn't have to sell them to be taxed by it. It would just be the gains on paper.
Right. Exactly. Those, for this subset of people, those paper gains would be treated as income.
Real gains.
Yeah.
Okay. So that would apply also to real estate.
Probably. I think one of the things that we're looking for as we're getting more details over in the coming days with specific legislative text, which we don't have yet, is there may be some differences in how the plan treats liquid assets like stocks and how it treats illiquid assets like real estate or closely held businesses or artwork. It may be that those don't require annual taxes, but that those things have still have taxes when you sell, but there's sort of an additional charge tacked onto that so that for the years between now and the sale date, the idea being that you shouldn't get an advantage from having those kinds of assets as opposed to publicly traded stock.
What if the value goes down? Does the government then pay people for the loss?
Maybe. I think what we're more likely to see is those losses being able to be carried forward or carried backward. And let me explain what that means. So remember our example from before where we had someone who had $2 billion worth of stock and it went up to $2.5 billion. Let's take it the other way. Someone had $2 billion of stock and it went down to $1.5 billion. Again, we'll see the details, but the idea is that $500 billion loss wouldn't generate an immediate refund. But then next year, if it went from $1.5 billion to $2 billion, that $500 billion gain, you could subtract the previous year's $500 loss and the two all basically wash out. So that over that two-year period, if you went down and then back up, there wouldn't be a tax due.
All right. Why this more narrow proposal? Because as you said earlier, this would apply to only 700 to 1,000 people.
Yeah, the larger wealth taxes have even more constitutional problems. And we can talk about what that might be with this tax and with the other wealth taxes. And they also don't have as much buy-in from lawmakers. I think the reason they landed on this is it's politically appealing to go after a very small group. There's no, you know, the arguments you would often hear about complexity don't really apply as much when you're dealing with very well-advised taxpayers who can hire, you know, as many accountants as they want. Beyond that, I think they've tried other ideas. They talked about changing how capital gains are taxed at death. They've talked about raising individual tax rates. And all, none of those things have yet been able to attract enough Democrats to get them through. And so they're turning to plan B or C or D or whatever this is to try and find something that raises revenue from really rich people and can get enough votes.
And by enough Democrats, you mean two, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema?
Well, no, by enough Democrats, I mean 50 in the Senate and 218 in the House. They're obviously the most prominent ones who we've seen have objections to some of the other proposals, but it's not necessarily the case that anything that they support will automatically get support from everyone else. And that's the messiness of legislating with these narrow majorities that Democrats are running into right now.
I want to play a clip from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She also spoke on CNN on Sunday with Jake Tapper. And here she is talking about this proposal.
Well, the billionaire's tax is, shall we say, has an appeal, but it doesn't produce that much money.
Okay.
Because the bill is not written yet, we hope it will be written today and introduced tomorrow. Only then can the Joint Tax Committee evaluate what it brings in. We anticipate $200, $250 billion, but we need closer to $2 trillion.
Okay, so it's not going to bring in that much, considering. What else are they considering to bridge the gap between $250 billion and $2 trillion?
I mean, it depends what hour you talk to them. It's, right now, we're in a very sort of state of limbo with the Democrats' revenue-raising proposals. Just this morning, Senator Manchin seemed to pour pretty cold water on an idea that was going to raise a couple hundred billion to require banks to report annual account flows for a lot of people to the IRS. They're still talking about higher taxes on U.S. companies' foreign earnings. They're talking about a corporate minimum tax. You know, when you hear the president talk about companies that pay no taxes, they're trying to kind of go after that. They've got a bunch of other sort of smaller ideas that add up to some money, and they're still working to try and figure out how they can get the whole thing together. It is not a fully baked cake at this point.
Right. Okay, if it is baked in, this thing, it could be challenged in the courts, and you alluded to the fact that it might not pass constitutional muster. How come?
So, yeah, this is a tricky question. And basically, the Constitution says, under the 16th Amendment, you can do income taxes and don't have to worry about a whole sort of crazy quilt scheme of apportionment that they used to have to do. But the argument here is that these might not be income taxes, that there's either you have to sell assets to have income, or that somehow that the definition defining wealth to determine who applies would mean that this is not an income tax. And so inevitably, because legal fees cost millions and the tax bills will be billions, there will be a pretty big incentive for someone to come after the government and sue and claim that this is unconstitutional, and it will take a couple of years to work its way through the court. There's almost no doubt in my mind that if this happens, there will be a well-funded piece of litigation coming.
Well, I imagine that the people who would be affected by this, they have an unlimited supply of tax specialists who could find ways to avoid this. So even if Nancy Pelosi says it could raise $200 to $250 billion, could that even be too optimistic, because people who are that rich are normally pretty good at evading taxes?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. The estimates from, she referred to the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation, was a nonpartisan team of experts that works for Congress that estimates these proposals. And they consider tax avoidance and taxpayer response and taxpayer behavior as part of those estimates. So, you know, obviously, if the whole thing is struck down, they're not going to consider that as part of their estimate. But they do make some assumptions and judgments about what really wealthy people will do if they're confronted with this tax. And so that's baked into whatever estimate they produce.
Richard Rubin covers tax policy for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the legal rights of nature. Can a river have legal standing to take polluters to court? That legal idea is being put into practice. We'll find out more next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Should trees have standing? legally, that is. 50 years ago, a USC law professor named Christopher Stone asked that question when he put forth the idea of giving legal rights to nature. It was a radical idea back then. It's still pretty radical today, but it's slowly catching on as a way to protect the environment in the face of climate change, deforestation, urban development. Here in the United States, it's mainly playing out in courtrooms at the local level. We're going to talk about this now with Katie Surma. She covers environmental justice for Inside Climate News. Katie, tell us more about Christopher Stone and his idea.
Sure. In the Law Review article, he laid out a pretty strong argument for why elements of nature should possess legal rights. And in that, he noted that many other non-human entities possess various forms of legal rights, so corporations and universities, trusts and governments. And he also drew parallels between this idea and past rights movements, like giving children rights, women's suffrage, and the civil rights movement. And it caught the eye of the Supreme Court that was deciding a case that touched on this issue. And Justice William O. Douglas, in a very famous dissent now, agreed with him. They couldn't get a majority of the court to sign on, but the idea was then out there.
How is it different from, let's say, a federal regulation that prohibits the toxic dumping of chemicals in rivers? What is the difference between a regulation like that and this kind of legal principle?
So the rights of nature would give elements of nature the highest form of protection under the law that the U.S. legal system recognizes, and that's to give it legal rights. So we tend to think of legal rights, you know, like civil rights, like free speech. And those rights cannot be infringed upon absent the most strongest showing of necessity. Advocates behind this movement say that typical environmental law is a system that allows pollution, that we permit certain amounts of pollution, we just regulate the extent and the pace of that pollution. And they say that, you know, those laws are great, they've done some good things, but we're in this ecological crisis right now, and we need another framework. And they say this rights of nature framework is the way forward because it would not just elevate the standing of nature under the law, but it would also change people's consciousness about how they view the natural world, that they would start to see it as a fellow form of being instead of property that we own, and when we look at something as property, we can destroy that property.
So it really seems to be how Native Americans have viewed nature, really as a living, breathing thing that we can't abuse.
That's right. The roots of this movement, it's widely acknowledged that the roots of the movement are in indigenous thought and worldview.
And where is this being used in practice?
So these laws, they're, you know, legislation, constitutional provisions, and court rulings, they've taken place all over the world. Within the United States, they're mainly at the local level, but I mean, some of the states that have these provisions on the books are Oregon, California, Colorado, Ohio, Pennsylvania. There's over 30 local U.S. laws and ordinances, and there's at least six tribal nations that have rights of nature provisions. And then examples of countries, Canada and Mexico, Bangladesh, Bolivia, and Uganda are just a handful.
And can you describe a case where this has been used as an argument and what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, right now in Florida, there's an active case going on where Orange County, Florida, passed a charter amendment during the 2020 election that recognized the rights of the waterways in that county to exist. And a developer filed to get a permit to be able to fill in wetlands to create a residential development. And these waterways have brought a lawsuit to stop that permit. And so that litigation is playing out. We can get into that a little bit more because there's a lot to that case. But another instance is in Ecuador, two individuals filed a lawsuit against a local government that had been developing an area near a river. The river was damaged from excavation material that had gone into it, and a court ruled in favor of the river and ordered the government to restore the river to its pre-injured condition.
And what is the pushback that is happening to this idea? I imagine that developers would say, look, if you take this idea to the extreme, then you could never build another house on land because that would damage the land and the perhaps the waterways and, you know, other parts of nature, that it would in effect stop all development. Is that in fact what they are arguing?
That's exactly right. A lot of the pushback has come from industry. Now, you have advocates on the other side saying that, hey, we're not Pollyannas. This isn't meant to stop every ecological injury. We're not talking about being in trouble for cutting down a tree or recreational hunting or some development. Their aim, they say, is to protect the integrity of ecosystems to make sure that they can survive and not be outpaced by the current pace of development. So, you know, property rights is also a major concern that this movement clashes right up against the Western idea of property rights and how important individual property rights are. How the laws in this litigation play out, it's going to be a battle between those two sides.
And we're talking about Florida and Orange County, the case you mentioned about the waterways. I understand a longtime legal rights of nature activist is suing because they're arguing that five waterways could be damaged by development. Is that coming to a head anytime soon, that case?
Yeah, so the defendants in that case, which are a developer and the head of Florida's Department of Environmental Protection, they filed a motion to dismiss that complaint. And we'll see, I mean, if the court makes a substantive ruling, it could be potentially precedent setting, and it for sure will be appealed.
And, you know, it's particularly acute in Florida because climate change is really apparent there in terms of what it's doing. Lots of the state is experiencing flooding and water coming up from below. So is that also thrusting this more into the mainstream, this idea?
Absolutely. The people on the ground in Florida who I've talked to have told me that, you know, one of the reasons why they think 87% of the 1.5 million voters in Orange County voted in favor of this rights of nature law is because the effects of pollution and climate change, it's very visceral there. People go outside and they see and they smell the toxic algae blooms. They see climate change and the intensity of the storms. And they are getting frustrated with their lawmakers for not doing something about it or not doing enough. So that's really driving the movement.
And what about in the rest of the country?
Similar. You know, Florida is definitely stands out as far as, you know, 87% of voters during the 2020 election. And we know how divisive that election was. But throughout the rest of the country, it is a locally driven movement. This is bottom up. It's local communities wanting to take back control over their immediate environment because they see state lawmakers as being too close to industry, that they're looking out for the interests of industry and not for local communities who have to deal with pollution up front.
So really, in that case, the rights of nature are really the rights of people to live in an environment that isn't polluted.
That's right. And it's, you know, the movement, the rights of nature movement, is very closely tied to this parallel movement for the human right to a clean environment.
Well, I've also heard of giving animals legal rights, too. There have been several cases involving that. Is that also related to this movement, or is it a separate kind of movement?
It is related to this movement. And, you know, that speaks to the local nature of these laws as well. You know, in Florida, for instance, I believe one of the constitutional amendments that's been proposed. So there's also a movement to enshrine in the Florida Constitution the rights of nature. And one of the things on the ballot is to give legal rights to some iconic species there. You know, whether it's a river or a mountain or a national park or an animal, a specific species of animal, it really depends on what's happening locally in that area.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Katie Surma. She covers environmental justice for Inside Climate News. Coming up, the director Ava DuVernay is here to talk about her new series about the football player Colin Kaepernick.
I mean, this is a story of a young person who listens to his own voice little by little and doesn't, he knows that that's not a mantra or a motto on a mug.
Ava DuVernay is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yeah.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There was an offer before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Well, today we're going to look at a new Netflix series which looks at the life of former NFL quarterback turned civil rights activist Colin Kaepernick. Not the Kaepernick we saw take a knee in protest of police brutality back in 2016, and not the Kaepernick we know today, who says he's up and training at 5 a.m. 6 days a week, so he's ready, just in case an NFL team calls. But the teenage Kaepernick. He's played by actor Jaden Michael in the series as he pursues his dream.
Being a quarterback is all I've ever wanted, my whole life. Every time I close my eyes, I read coverages. Every night I sleep, I dream of playing in the Super Bowl. It's the only way I know how to operate and the only way I want to. Being a quarterback isn't an option for me. It's in my blood. And I'm gonna get there one way or another.
Colin in Black and White is Kaepernick's origin story, retold as a drama. The real Colin Kaepernick narrates his story as we see it unfold on screen. Mary Louise Parker and Nick Offerman play his white parents. Kaepernick was adopted when he was an infant. We see his struggles as a black kid in a largely white community. Even his own parents don't fully understand what he's going through. Joining us now is filmmaker Ava DuVernay. She created the series with Colin Kaepernick. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me. I listen to this all the time, so I'm happy to be with you.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that and happy to have you. Well, talk about this collaboration between you two. When did it begin?
You know, I met him at the Time 100 event. I think it was 2018, really close to when he was making, you know, ripples through the news with his protests. We were like-minded almost immediately. He got in touch with me a couple of months later and asked if I'd be interested in talking to him about telling parts of his story. And I was surprised when he was interested in telling about his teenage years. At first I thought, this is not really the part I want to tell, to be honest with you. But as I started to talk to him and hear the stories about his teenage years, I started to see stories in my head about microaggression and othering and privilege and access and culture and history and legacy and memory. And it all kind of came to life in my head in a way that I thought, oh yeah, there is something here to do and something here to say. And so we joined hands and started on our way.
Mm. So did you do lots of interviews with him to find out how his childhood went and what he experienced?
Many, many hours, many, many days, mm-hmm. many, many weeks and months. And, you know, we worked on this for about 2.5 years.
Wow.
You know, it's hard to tell your story in hindsight. to especially this, these years on the surface look like, you know, just normal adolescence. But they really added up to a quite spectacular journey that in this moment has ripple effects on culture and society and politics around the world, really. I was talking to some journalists from the UK yesterday who were talking about, you know, players there taking a knee and what that means to the leagues there and how it's been discussed in Parliament. And so this all starts with this guy who's standing on the shoulders of athletes like Tommy Smith and Muhammad Ali. And then you even see ripples of the effect of what he's done, you know, in a Naomi Osaka or a Simone Biles as it relates mm-hmm. to athletes standing up for themselves and expressing themselves outside of the systems that they play within. I became really passionate about trying to weave all of this into a story about a teenager from Turlock, California.
Right. And so you want to find out about the roots of this activism and the roots of his awakening. And it's not entirely clear exactly where he's getting his inspiration, but he is feeling it bit by bit, feeling that he is not like his parents, not like the people in his community, and feeling a sense that he needs to discover who he is. Who is the young Colin Kaepernick?
He is a young person who is self-animated, right? He's self-starting. You know, a lot of times, you know, in these stories, you'll put in a character or a citing incident that is the reason why the person is the way they are, right? Mm-hmm. But in real life, you know, those don't always happen. Sometimes they are small, little moments that all came together. It's not often like a movie. For some people it is, but sometimes it's the small moments of your life, the steps that leads you on the journey to where you're going to be. And this is how he describes his childhood. He was a black child adopted by white parents living in a predominantly white town and really attracted to blackness, but with nothing anchoring that in his own life. In fact, forces in his own life saying, don't be attracted to that, be attracted to us, we love you, which is not a bad thing. But this duality, you know, this bifurcation of his identity, became something where you see that he had to actually self-start and self-determine in order to certainly kind of propel himself forward. But when you imagine that, it gets to a place where he is on the worldwide stage, standing in his convictions, it becomes all the more fascinating.
Yeah. So he didn't get it at home. He didn't get this idea of black liberation at home. In fact, quite the opposite. His parents, as they're portrayed in your series, are very loving, but they don't get it. And they are, in fact, they chafe at his attempts to connect with his black heritage. They don't want him to wear braids or an afro. They make him cut his hair. His mom doesn't really like the fact that he is attracted to a black girl. She calls his attraction a phase. And is this something that Colin told you happened in his childhood and was something that was upsetting to him, that his parents were trying to push him away from black culture?
Well, yeah, everything that's in the piece is based on what he told us. And, you know, he was very involved in the writing process and in the production process and the editorial process. So in trying to make anything, I always have to understand as best I can where all the characters are coming from in order to direct them, in order to produce a piece. And so I did struggle with kind of trying to understand what the parents were afraid of, you know, what they were pushing against. And when I came upon the notion that, they're just doing the best they can because they see he is them. It's not mm-hmm. like they don't want him to be like something else, right? It was more, be like us. You don't have to go through those things that other black boys go through. Don't wear your hair like that. Be like us. It's easier over here. We've got you. We love you. It's okay. And so when I really got to this place of understanding and really thinking deeply about, you know, these are well-meaning people who loved him and love him, right? But there was something for him that was taking him in another direction. That push and pull didn't come from a reject blackness. It came from who your family, be like your family. And that really was clarifying for all of us as we went down a path of telling Colin's story, but really making sure that we were not doing a disservice to this family who who loved and embraced him in ways that worked and in ways that bristled and in ways that were healthy and maybe in ways that aren't healthy. But isn't that all of our families?
Yeah. So. You know, and maybe they were afraid of losing him, too. And that's why they did that. Like, they didn't want to lose their son whom they loved.
You know, in some ways you can analyze it that him, you know, embracing blackness is losing something, you know, where other people see it as a gain. It's hard to know. For us, yeah. For me, what I did was really be as focused on the story that I was telling, the lens that I was telling it through. On When They See Us, I focused on telling the stories through the eyes of the boys. So I did not, you know, really deal with police and prosecutors and even their own families. It was their story. I committed to tell their story. And the same for Colin. I committed to tell his story, his remembering of what the child was like. So I think it'll be interesting to hear from coaches and family as they kind of take in his version of the story. But that's what we stayed faithful to.
Yeah. There's one point, because the real Colin Kaepernick narrates, and he says something really incredibly sad towards the end of the series. He notes that his parents were in line to adopt someone else, and that fell through, a different baby, and so he was offered to them. And then he says, since the day I was born, I've never been anybody's first choice.
Yeah.
I just thought that was incredibly sad and poignant. How does that idea sit with him? How does it affect him?
You know, I think just from what I've observed, he takes that as a badge of honor. That he might not be the first choice. That was the case for different aspects of his sports career. It certainly is how he feels about his family life. But that he takes that as fuel, as food, as fire. Like, it really drives him from what I've observed. And it's not something that he mourns or is sad about. It's a fact as he experiences it. And it is a part of him that he, I won't say embraces, but he, it is a part of his story that he accepts and allows to propel him, and as opposed to hold him back.
Yeah. So he, as we know his story, he did become quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. And then he was released as a free agent in 2017, and he's remained unsigned ever since. So I guess I'm wondering, after a lifetime of this treatment, how he manages. As I said in the intro, he gets up to work out every day at 5 a.m. in the hopes he'll be signed again. How does he manage to hold on to his optimism about not just the NFL, but about America?
I'm sorry. It's hard to be in his head beyond the work that we've done together. I think part of it is this work. Part of it is his work with Know Your Rights camp. Part of it is, you know, the continuous kind of pushing against social ills that he's constantly doing. I know he's writing a book, he's working on a documentary. I think these ways of expressing himself are possibly part of the answer to your question.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I wish you could ask him. I'm not sure.
Well, and what about you? I mean, how does his story, you have, you know, put forth similar themes in your movies and in your documentary work. And I'm just wondering where this fits in with your vision.
Well, you know, I try to work on things that I'm attracted to. And the things that I'm attracted to is work that kind of sticks to your ribs and might, you know, shift or challenge your view of the world, or, you know, have you embracing parts of yourself or your experience or someone else's experience that you might not have considered or that you want to consider further. So this, you know, is on a continuum of that kind of effort. It's a bit lighter in that, you know, we've got some moments of real levity and joy that comes across in this. I mean, this is a story of a young man finding himself. And what he finds, he starts to like, he starts to embrace. I mean, this is a story of a young person who listens to his own voice little by little, and doesn't, he knows that that's not a mantra or a motto on a mug or a bumper sticker, you know, to listen to your own voice, to trust your own power. This is a muscle that needs to be exercised little by little for all of us. And so in the series, you see this kid against all odds, against everything that's around him, kind of leaning in and listening to his own voice. It's something that I feel is a bit of a through line through some of my work, whether we're thinking about the Exonerated Five and their voices that were so long kind of locked away, if you're thinking of King and the Freedom Fighters in Selma, or even 13th, mm-hmm. or even Meg in A Wrinkle in Time. You know, it's about focusing in on that inner thing that's telling you, that inner guidance. And so I think that might be one of the reasons why I was really attracted to this.
Let me ask you, since this is in the news and your series is coming out on Netflix, and Netflix is facing just a real backlash over Dave Chappelle's comedy special for the jokes and comments he made about trans people and the LGBTQ community. And there seems to be a real upheaval within the network, as well as among some people, you know, people on the outside in the culture. Because you are also working with Netflix and your series is about race and justice, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this whole controversy.
I don't know enough about it. I haven't watched it, but I do know, I haven't had the time to watch it, but I do know that people feel diminished. And whenever mm-hmm. someone is feeling diminished, they deserve to be heard, and that that space should be allowed for that to be heard and that to be processed and that to be evaluated and for change to be considered or made. I'm unfortunately launching two shows in 1 month, and so I'm in production on three things. So I haven't been completely up on what other people are doing in that regard, but I do know that there are people who feel unseen, mistreated, and that whenever that's the case, there should be a space for listening. And so I really hope that happens. It might have. I don't know what's going on there. But that's my hope for this kind of situation in all its forms, anywhere where we find it.
Mm. How are you seeing from the inside streaming outlets and networks, cable networks, even regular broadcast networks, in handling more diverse material these days? Do you see there's more material, there are more shows like that coming up and more avenues for people of color? And what are these places missing? What are they not doing that they should be doing more of?
There's definitely more than there were even 5 years ago. And I don't really think of it from a negative place. I mean, I'm just no longer interested in analyzing what people aren't doing. I'm more focused on what mm-hmm. I am doing. I've done so many years of kind of talking about the problems that other people are having. You know, people need to fix their own problems. For me, I see a lot of Black, Brown, women creators doing more than it was before. Is it enough? Is there enough space on the dial? Is it equitable? You know, is it balanced? That's for other people to count and to worry about. I worried about that for a long time, and I counted it for a long time. And I think, you know, for me, I really turned a corner to say, I can do panels, I can do interviews, I can talk about it, write about it, think about it, or I can try to disrupt in the ways that I can, trying to build equitable systems, to change the way that I work on sets, to change the way that I present in meetings, to ask for the things that I feel are right and just and equitable, and to make work that speaks to the things that are important to me, and to support others who do the same. So that's kind of where I am with it.
Yeah. And when did you come to that change of perspective?
Oh, it's progressive. It's just kind of like the same thing I talk about with Kaepernick. You know, these are steps. It's little by little. It's not one moment. It's being in this business as a filmmaker for 10 years, seeing the ups and downs of our industry. You know, some of it's performative, some of it's genuine. Am I the one to be the judge of it? I could, but is that the best use of my time? Probably not. I just want to try to make things that feel muscular, that feel meaningful to me. And in doing so, try to help others along. And so I found that the way to do that is to focus on the work as opposed to the people who aren't doing the work, who I have problems with. I just try to have less problems, Madeline. You know what I'm saying? these days. So that's kind of the flow I'm in at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it has been a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to talk to you.
You too. That's Ava DuVernay. Colin in Black and White debuts on Netflix October 29th. Coming up, an art collective bought an Andy Warhol drawing for $20,000, created 999 fakes, and then sold all 1,000 for $250 apiece. one person received the original but might never know it. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, imagine buying an original Andy Warhol drawing for just $250. Now, if you're thinking, oh, it's got to be a fake, you're both right and wrong. A group called Mischief recently bought an original Warhol drawing for $20,000. Then they digitally recreated it. They made 999 copies, and they aged them to look exactly like the original. And they're selling the copies plus the original for $250 each. So if you buy, you might get a fake, or you might be the lucky person who gets the original. Joining me now is Lucas Bentel, Chief Creative Officer at Mischief. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how did you come up with this idea?
I mean, the idea came out of thinking about value in art and just around how we could use sort of the process of multiplication as a form of destruction in some sense.
You mean multiplying the original means destroying the original, the value of it?
Yeah, anybody who would in the future buy one of these pieces and think that they might have the original, I think would be a little bit crazy at this point in time.
So how did you make the fakes look like the original?
Yeah, so they actually aren't digitally reproduced. We went through a pretty intense process of actively forging these works using, you know, some accelerated artificial aging processes for the paper to, you know, making sure we were using the right inks to just going all out producing these forgeries. So from the eye, you cannot tell them apart at all. At this point in time, they're all mixed up. We have no idea where the real one will be going.
Wait, you don't even know the difference? You can't tell?
No. I think if you were to actually do a really close analysis with some really good instruments, you might be able to tell, but it would be very difficult at this point.
Wow. So you did destroy the original in a way.
Essentially, although not physically. It still exists. It's still out in the world, but there are just many more copies of it.
Well, does the Warhol Foundation or the estate have anything to say about this?
We have not heard anything from them. We did not ask them for permission or comment. And honestly, I figure Andy Warhol might like this piece himself. So,
why do you think he might like it?
I mean, he definitely is someone, his whole body of work, his factory was sort of building towards the world we live in where, you know, art can be mass produced. And where an artist doesn't necessarily have to make their own work. So this was an original Andy Warhol drawing. So his hand did physically touch this object. We're destroying it like one of his prints might.
Mm. Right. So when you mass produce something, the original just loses its monetary value. Are you also talking about just how we value art? I mean, it seems so arbitrary.
Yeah. I mean, I think authenticity, scarcity are like big parts of the art world and big parts of the reason certain things are valuable. They're valuable because there's only one of them. There's not that many. And so we're sort of taking that at its core and saying, hey, we can multiply this work and put it out for many, many more people. Many more people might possibly have an Andy Warhol than previously had an Andy Warhol. It's also much cheaper to acquire a piece like this, as opposed to a singular piece by Andy Warhol that isn't duplicated.
Well, also, if you sell all of these, you can make a tidy profit, right? Because,
yeah,
you could make $250,000 if you sell them all, right?
Yeah, so we have sold all of them at this point in time. They sold out pretty quickly. And I think in some ways, we're just accelerating that art world profit. We've done similar pieces before. We took a Damien Hirst spot painting where he, you know, he basically prints these like money, but they're a bunch of dots on a painting, mm-hmm. chopped out all the dots, resold all the individual dots to people, and made more money reselling the dots than the painting was initially worth. There's a very funny story we have from that experience where when getting the painting from the gallery that we bought it from, the gallerist said, congratulations on your purchase. This should appreciate by 2 or 3x in the next 5 to 10 years. And we did that in the next, you know, 48 hours. But in some sense, this is playing with value in the art world, in the art market. It's such a nebulous space to exist within to start with.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So what are you? Because you don't just operate in the art world. You operate in the commerce world, too. Like, you have redone Nike sneakers, including one with Lil Nas X, where you put human blood on these sneakers, these Satan sneakers, and then sold a lot of them. What, 666 pairs?
Yeah, yeah. 600.
Number, obviously symbolic, and at more than $1,000 a piece. So are you also just a company making money off this stuff?
We are a artist group, an artist collective. We're about 20 people that work collectively on these projects, these pieces. And we really see ourselves as a group that's taking a lot of the way artists think about things, but dealing with subject matter that actually interacts with the world at large. So if we're working with something, we want to push it into a space that engages not just people in a white gallery box, but engages sort of a larger public. And we're not medium specific. So I think we say we're artists because the way we think about the world is definitely coming from the lens of critical artists, but we engage with the world like everybody else does, where you walk outside and you see businesses all over the place. So we operate as a business as well. It sort of comes hand in hand. I think to exist today and not understand that the big artists like Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons, they are just big companies. Yeah, I mean, you'd be crazy not to think that at this point.
Right. And I remember several years back, the artist Murakami, he had a store inside Mocha where he was showing his art. But inside there was a Louis Vuitton branded Murakami store.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting thing. The levels that artists and brands live on is, when you get up there, can be quite equal or parallel. And I think we understand that, realize that, and are willing to actually engage with spaces that are not purely in an art space or purely in a business commerce space.
And do you have a judgment on it one way or the other? Do you think this is good or bad for art?
I mean, I think I will reserve a judgment for people looking at the piece, but it's such an interesting way of, you know, looking at both the trajectory of Andy Warhol as an artist, where, I mean, he really was the artist that sort of predicted these giant, you know, blue chip artists that exist today, and taking sort of some of his thoughts and thinking and pushing it into a piece like this. You know, I think it's a fairly compelling object. And I think anybody that got one, even if they don't get what might be the original one, should be fairly happy with their purchase. They might have an Andy Warhol, and that's probably as close as, it's closer than the majority of us will ever get.
Lucas Bentel, Chief Creative Officer at Mischief, which just unleashed a new drop, a bunch of Andy Warhols. Most of them fake, one of them real. Lucas, thank you.
All right, thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Tomorrow, we're talking about what motivates human behavior, carrot or stick. Well, in the case of vaccine holdouts, it appears the stick works better. But what about for other public health endeavors, like getting people to quit smoking or wear seatbelts? We'll talk about that on tomorrow's show. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great rest of your day, and I will see you tomorrow. Thank you.